House Bill 3372. Mark, you want to explain what we're looking at?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We are looking at Dash 5 amendments for 3372, which incorporate the Dash 4s, which is the CJIS program, and adds to that the removal of the Secretary of State and the State Treasurer from DAS control of IT asset management, but it still requires them to have the same obligations as other agencies. And so that's the one addition. Actually, there's two additions. The second is that it incorporates all the definitions for CJIS for the agent or for the groups within CJIS onto one page. Mr. Chair.
Are you comfortable with that?
Mm-hmm.
Representative Patridge?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 3372.
Representative Patridge moves the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 3372. Discussion? Is there any objection to the adoption of the Dash 5?
Not to be picky, but page 2, line 27, all the FOILs below subparagraph 3, starting at line 10, continuing on through line 26, are lowercase, and at line 27, there's an uppercase L.
Mark.
Mr. Chair. Representative Lowe, I can answer that question. I checked into this with legislative counsel, and they informed me that they use the capital L intentionally to not have it confused with I in the lowercase L form.
Like the story. Okay, let me just take another minute. At least you know I'm looking at it, right?
There we go. Is there any objection to the adoption of the Dash 5 amendments? Hearing seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3372 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Patridge moves House Bill 3372 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? And seeing none, so ordered.
Do you want to carry it?
No.
Okay. I'll be happy to carry it.
Representative Patridge will carry the bill. Let's we'll briefly go into a work session on House Bill 2988. Colleagues, in your book, and anybody who's interested, we'll get copies to you. We've got just the draft concept language that we'll send to LC. From the work group on House Bill 2988, so we'll schedule that again. We'll take testimony on the next time and schedule it up for work session again. So just want to bring that to your attention. If you have any issues or questions, talk to Mark. Report back that Roy Hemingway joined the work group and helped craft in terms of this concept.
Is the commission okay with this?
Mark, do you want to report back who's part of the work group?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Members of the work group were Jenny Lang, Tom Barkin from PUC, Gary Bauer, and Bruce Sampson.
Gotcha.
And, I'm sorry, excluding Bob Jenks was also present at the work groups. And then today, Roy Hemingway was present for the work group. And might I add that this is Roy Hemingway's suggested amendment. Mr. Chair.
So we will get it in the LC version.
And is there some... Thank you, Mr.
We'll present the concept behind it.
Can I ask one other question? Is there some sort of a definition that exists somewhere as to what exactly is a major proceeding?
I think that'll be one of those issues that LC will address.
Okay.
And they interpret it, and then we can have that defined
okay.
as part of the discussion.
Thank you.
Okay. We will close the work session on House Bill 2988. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 3696. And Mark, you want to explain briefly that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3696 limits the authority of the Public Utility Commission to regulate services of utilities, defines regulated services and unregulated activity, directs the commission to interpret and administer public utility laws to accomplish specific goals relating to the generation and use of electricity and other forms of energy. It clarifies that the commission does not have jurisdiction to regulate any unregulated activity, authorizes the commission to enter into regulated service contracts for the provision of electricity or natural gas services, specifies terms of these contracts. It authorizes the commission through regulated service contracts to establish rates for electricity and natural gas consumers and to collect, deposit, and determine certain distributions for consumer payments. Eliminates the limitation on the amortization of certain deferred amounts for rate-setting purposes. And lastly, defines transmission company and extends to transmission companies certain laws applicable to electrical utilities. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mark. Pam and John, are you going to come? Pam? Welcome.
Yes, I
Jay? Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John DiLorenzo. I'm an attorney from Portland, and I am here today on behalf of my client, Portland General Electric. With me today is Ms. Pamela Lesh, the Vice President in charge of Rates and Regulatory Affairs for PGE, and also Mr. Jay Dudley, who is the Assistant General Counsel for PGE. We are here today to testify in favor of House Bill 3696, which advocates a modern idea, a way of moving from the cost of service approach to utility regulation, which has prevailed during most of the last century, to an approach which emphasizes the quality and the quantity of services provided by utilities by first authorizing utility service contracts and secondly by permitting utilities to engage in non-regulated competitive business activity outside the scope of the provision of actual utility service. That's basically what the bill is about. Ms. Lesh will discuss, with your permission, the theory and the concepts behind the bill. Mr. Dudley is then prepared to walk the committee through the various sections of the bill.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Pamela Lesh. I won't repeat my title. I do appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today about the bill we drafted, which, as John said, is to provide really a 21st century way of regulating public utility services. This bill has two primary purposes. The first is to give the commission, not force them to use it, but to give them a new tool for regulating our services. Building on the last 50 years, when we've learned a lot about how to contract for services, how to get what you want, talk about it up front, write it down, live within that framework, I decided that might be a useful way to go about getting our utility services in the future. And so this bill authorizes the commission to enter into such contracts. And it begins, it doesn't complete the process, it just begins to shift the focus of regulation from where it's been for the last 100 years, which is on the company, which the company then provides this monolithic bundled service, to the services themselves, and ultimately then pave the way for other people to offer those services once we've defined them well. As John said, I'm just going to spend a few minutes grounding you in why we've done this, and then Jay Dudley will walk you through the sections of the bill. Let me start at the beginning, and that's how we're regulated now. It's essentially what's called cost of service. You might recognize it more as cost plus. We start by adding up all our costs. We add the cost to raise money, whether that's to borrow it or to raise capital, equity capital. We divide by some unit, that's usually a kilowatt hour, and there you have the rate. That, as John said, that hasn't changed much in the last 100 years. Oh, various pieces of it shift from time to time, but that's pretty much the idea, and it worked really well for what it was intended to do, which was get electric infrastructure built all over this country. It worked really well because it encouraged us, utilities, to grow by putting in more infrastructure. The more we put in, the bigger rate base we had, and the more we grew as a company. But over the decades, some flaws with this have emerged, as have the many flaws people have noted with cost plus generally. And I think they've begun to outweigh its usefulness, particularly now that we're really not in a place where we need to add a lot of infrastructure, certainly on distribution, the distribution side. We've built it out by and large, and now we need to really work to get people to use it more efficiently. The flaws that I usually talk about are in three categories. The first category I call investment stuffed and feedback starved. The basic premise of this whole system is if we build it, now we have to do that prudently, but if we build it, customers will pay. It's a little bit of Field of Dreams. I'd like to flip that. If it's useful, if it produces the right result, customers would support it. This system regulates profits. It regulates the very end of the equation. It doesn't regulate what we actually do. It doesn't regulate our results. Hence some of the well-publicized problems with various other utility services. The commission really cannot get to good service. What they can do is regulate utility profits. And they have penalties and disallowances to use as tools for things we do that they don't like, but they don't have many tools to get the things that they do want. So regulation as it is right now is fairly reactive. The feedback happens after the fact. It doesn't happen up front. So the system that's emerged, my next category of flaws, is pretty innovation poor and win-lose rich. Cost of service institutionalizes being risk averse. You won't find many entities more averse to risk than utilities. Now, you wouldn't necessarily believe that watching what's been happening to some utilities, but I would tell you that in some ways it's that very risk aversion that's made utilities ill-suited to deal with the market that developed over the last couple of years. Most don't have the processes in place to recognize the risk or manage it because we're risk averse. Basically, if we take a risk, the best we do is we get our costs back. We maybe get to keep some benefit of that gamble that we made between rate cases, but you never know when a rate case is going to be, and the commission could initiate one at any time. And so it is the perception that that's going to happen, perhaps more than the reality, that keeps us from doing and taking the gamble in the first place. Cost of service is also an equation. At the end of the day, you have rates on one side, you have our costs on the other. And I would tell you that what that forces to happen is to the extent that cost side goes up, that's a lose to consumers. They must have lost something. Rates go down, that's a lose to us. There's no way to make this a win-win situation, and that's because we can't ever talk about value. We can only talk about cost. And finally, what I really don't like about cost of service and the way we're regulated now is we don't have a customer. We do call our ratepayers customers. We grind that into our heads because we want to treat them that way, but they're not really. They can't choose us. And the commission can't choose us either. They can't fire us if they don't like what we're doing, and we can't fire them if our owners decided they didn't want to be in the business any longer. And I spent a little bit of time out in the commercial services world and realized one thing very important about that ability of a customer and a supplier to, in effect, walk away from each other if they weren't getting along. And that's that it really encouraged them to get along. It disciplined the relationship because you really didn't want to fire your supplier. You were used to them, and you didn't really want to get rid of that customer. You liked that customer. But knowing that it could happen made people sit down and really work together to resolve differences. So looking at all this, it occurred to us that that really wasn't the most productive way to regulate in the future, particularly in a time of great change. This system worked pretty well when technological advancement was slow, evolutionary. There wasn't a heck of a lot going on. It's not working well with the kind of environment we have now. So we first decided let's have some criteria to guide what a new framework might look like. And there were really three things we wanted to do. One was to have the commission focus on policing the what, policing our results, not the how we do it, and particularly not necessarily how much it costs. It's that how that is unproductive. What they really want is the result. The second thing we wanted to do was borrow from the best commercial relationships. We wanted a system that would encourage both sides to really listen to each other, to learn together, to work through uncomfortable issues like what's really going to happen if this goes wrong or if that happens. You have to do that, and you have to do that ahead of time, because once it's happened, you need to know what you're going to do or you're in a world of hurt. And finally, maybe most important, we wanted to get to a place where we could align success. The better we, our customers did, the better we did. The worse our customers did, however you define that success for customers, the worse we did. No more win-lose. We moved together. And then we wanted to embrace and really use the changes in the economy happening out there. And that's the rise of the knowledge worker, the people who spend most of their time thinking rather than making things, and the use of the Internet. All those can support a new way of doing regulation. Based on these principles, we set some goals. We wanted results to be what matter and the rewards to follow the results, not investment driving rewards. Investment may not be the right answer. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But really have the result drive the reward. We wanted to get those results by design, by having defined them up front. And then we wanted to put systems in place to check and make sure we got what people thought we were going to get. We want to get rid of the terms ratepayer and regulator and have a term customer. We wanted innovative people who would drive innovation. We wanted utilities to attract the best people, not necessarily the most risk-averse people, just the best people. And we wanted a lot of feedback and dialogue. And that led us to one path. There's probably lots of ways to meet those goals, but one path was a contract framework. That really would substitute for what I think is broken in the regulatory compact that we all used to talk about, sometimes still talk about. The regulatory compact was always ill-defined and less well understood. Let's do a contract instead. We'll define what we want up front. We'll perform to it. We won't seek to steer from behind using disallowance and profit regulation on decisions that are already made and past being influenced, and allow win-win. We envision the commission as the negotiator of these contracts, deciding many of the same issues. What's the service? What are the performance criteria? What's the compensation of the utility? Much of the same things they deal with now, just in a little more coherent framework than a rate case. So the commission would negotiate these contracts, but that would not occur necessarily as you might think of a supplier and a customer, not two people sitting down at the table. We envisioned a fairly significant public process. It would depend on how large the thing was we were contracting for. If it was a small generating unit, it might be a fairly streamlined process. If it was our entire distribution service, this might be a year-long process with testimony and interventions and so forth. Then the commission would adopt this contract in a final order, which is appealable. So if somebody's really unhappy with what the commission's done, they can appeal it and say it's not within the commission's authority as achieving adequate service at reasonable rates. Then the commission would be responsible for designing and making the rates that people would pay to receive the services covered by the contract, and they would act as the contract administrator, monitor our compliance. Are we meeting the performance commitments? If we don't perform, assessing the damage penalties that are provided for, making or responding to requests for change orders, I call them. You never do it, never get it exactly right. There's always something about the service you want to change. They'd be responsible for that. And then preparing for and handling what we're going to do at the end of the contract. Do we renegotiate? Do they do a bid? Whatever we've provided for that could happen. Customers would be the beneficiaries of this contract and could act to enforce its terms if the commission didn't. We saw this as a very proactive role for the commission and one that should be satisfying because they could achieve success on behalf of utility consumers, not just work for the lowest rates. The lowest rate isn't always the most value. The services that might be particularly suitable for this right now include new generation. We have state policies that new generation should not come into rate base, which means customers are stuck with it pretty much for 30 or 40 years. And these new contracts could be a way to have the output used for customers under terms that we all decide up front. Other things include metering or discrete components of construction and maintenance services, even undergrounding services. All of that might be suitable for our contract approach. The other change in the bill, which supports this concept, but is useful and even beyond it, is to move from regulating the company to regulating services. We want to eventually get to a place where we have a box around what a utility service is and how you connect to it, and then everything outside the box is competitive, whether we work in that arena or it's simply other people, and we all know how we access what's inside the box. We think that will promote the most innovation over time. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Jay for a section-by-section walkthrough, unless there are questions I can answer.
Are there any questions? In terms of, in this concept, do you define contract in the traditional sense of a contract? Once you enter into it, then you can rely upon that to operate your business, and that if the parties, somebody, if they're going to break it, you then can go and say, wait a minute, I'm relying on the fact you told me I could still do X, Y, Z. I live up to my obligations. You need to live up to your obligations.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's exactly what we envision. And so obviously one critical piece would be how long do you want this contract to run? If there's a lot of uncertainty in the environment, you might say, let's do this for a year. Then we'll revisit. If there isn't a lot of uncertainty, you might say, you know, it would behoove us to do this for 5 years or maybe even 10. That's why we provided that long a period. And you might negotiate reopeners that you put in the contract. We could reopen if this or if that. And I remember somebody asked me once about, well, what about the 8.9 earthquake? Well, you know, if Portland gets hit by an 8.9 earthquake, we're probably going to need a lot of help beyond whatever we've contracted for. That's one of those catastrophes you can't really cover. But that's exactly what we're trying to achieve, is we would know the rules for that period of time, and we would have a way to extend, renew, bid, whatever, not have to return to cost of service. So that once and for all, we could break that mindset and go do smart things.
Are any other states doing this?
I wish I could say yes, Representative, but I'm not aware of any. There are some in one state, in Connecticut, Mr. Chairman and Representative Partridge, I believe the decommissioning of a nuclear plant was handled under a contract. The commission sat down with the entity that was going to do the decommissioning and very carefully worked out who would bear what risk. That's the only example I'm aware of at this point.
Has this been debated in other legislators and other bodies across the United States?
You're the first.
Well, that's always nice to be a nice.
Oregon is a leader.
What is the risk here in terms of? I mean, to me, it seems to be rather risk adverse in terms of if you enter into a contract and do your proper due diligence in terms of, so I'm just trying to understand in terms of why anyone would be, feel uncomfortable if, one, it's discretionary on the part of the commission, and two, in terms of it's a full and open process going forward, you know, what is the risk here that, to me it doesn't sound that earth-shattering. We do it all the time in the private sector. Why wouldn't it work here? It's like devil's advocate on your own bill.
Mr. Chairman, I'll try, but I honestly really don't know. It is discretionary, and I understand that we would have a pretty steep hill to climb to get the commission to see this. On the other hand, could be very useful, so I think it's climbable. The risk is, I guess, that you haven't anticipated everything. And
that risk could flow on both sides of the equation.
Absolutely.
If you've miscalculated on your side, you're going to bear that cost and try to negotiate to reopen it up, and the commission can say no.
Right.
Live with it.
At the extremes, I think there is the belief that if things went really poorly for us, if we really underestimated what we would need and were on the verge of bankruptcy, then the commission would have no choice but to step in. Whereas if it was the other way around, if we were doing wonderfully under this contract, there'd be no recourse. To address that, I think you would negotiate terms in the contract to ensure that we were maintaining financial health and give the commission some ability to step in if we were not, and begin to make arrangements to transfer the service if we couldn't, if it looked like we were going to get to a place where we couldn't perform. But ultimately, I suppose that is the risk that people would talk about, and by being such an extreme one, bankruptcy, it's pretty hard to address that. Utility bankruptcies aren't common. And again, I think we would attempt to take that into consideration. If we were contracting to provide power, I don't think we'd probably set a 10-year fixed price. Not in today's environment. I think we'd know better. But that would be the sort of thing that could get you into a lot of trouble if you had done it and not allowed any reopeners or anything.
So, any further questions?
Yeah, I've got a lot of questions.
Hello?
I'm going to need a little help in framing the questions that I have. Can you read my mind? I haven't. So basically what, as I'm reading this and looking at the bill, I think that what you're trying to get at, correct me if I'm wrong, is to fix it so that the cost of new generation of supply, which you can't pass on to ratepayers right now under the present scheme, could be contractually, as a matter of, included in the contract terms and passed on to ratepayers. Is that basically what would happen under this, or am I misunderstanding what you're saying?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lowe, that's one example. The Commission's policy adopted as part of the 1149 implementation is that new resources, whoever they're developed by, would happen outside of the old framework, which is that we built everything we needed to serve our customers. We still need to provide power for our customers and are doing that. Most of that we acquire from third parties. But if, for example, our owners wanted to invest some money in new generation, one way we could then use that generation on behalf of our customers would be to sit down with the commission and say, here's the terms under which we will use this output. We might price it at some percentage off market because we're going to they're going to commit to buy it for a number of years. There's endless flexibility really in how you would arrange it, but it would bring it in under the same terms we might agree to buy power from Avista Energy Services or PG&E Energy Services. Those same types of terms and conditions we essentially could work out just using a resource that we had invested in rather than PG&E Energy Services.
So basically this would allow you to be in not only the production side but the supply side, which is not allowed now. Is that correct?
We are now in the supply side.
Distribution side.
We're now in the distribution side, and we are in the supply side to the extent we have an obligation to go get power.
To go and find some, yeah. But in the event that the suppliers, those traditional suppliers from who you acquire the energy to bundle out to it,
mm-hmm.
If they become insolvent, if they become iffy, if the price becomes way too high, is what you're proposing going to protect Oregonians from catastrophic rates? Or will it make them more vulnerable to catastrophic rates?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lowe, it does provide just one more entity that the Commission could look to, could have us look to sign up for long-term supplies if that's what they want to do. Essentially, the longer-term commitment you make to a supplier, the flatter your price will be. The high volatility comes when you've looked to the market on a day-by-day basis. Any kind of a contractual arrangement between us and the Commission or between us and a market or the Bonneville Power Administration or Puget Sound Energy, if we make a long-term commitment, we'll get a more reasonable price. It's going to be a price based on both the physical cost of the resource and any risk that we've asked the seller to take. If, for example, the seller is providing us power from a gas-fired plant, if we ask the seller to take the risk of the gas price, then it'll probably will pay more, but we won't pay a different price as the gas price changes, if you understand what I mean. If we take the gas price risk, in other words, the price can change as gas changes, then we'll probably pay less up front, but our price might change as the fuel changes. Those are risks that have to be worked out in advance.
Experiment would basically shift the burden of risk for supply acquisition onto the ratepayer.
Again, Mr. Chairman and Representative, no, it wouldn't change anything about that. If the Commission wanted to make a different risk allocation because it achieved a result they wanted, they could do that. If they wanted no change, they could do that also.
Let me a clarifying question here. In terms of under today's structure, and if we look at the evil California in terms of what has occurred down there, where we have divestiture of generation assets from distribution, and then we want to talk about the rate cap issue in terms of, you know, it would seem to me that if you're going to be crafting a policy in which you want to have a stable source of energy in a unstable marketplace, that it would be to the benefit of ratepayers to be have a captured or close source of generation to backfill market, and that is at odds. That concept is at odds with 1149, in which all ratepayers are actually at risk of higher market prices because it would fully express the PGE would not have any generation assets to rely on. And if energy is sold elsewhere and there's not enough capacity, PGE does rolling blackouts. You have no place to go to generate more electricity.
Right. Mr. Chairman and Representative Lowe, 1149 doesn't require us to divest anything, and we're not planning to. And we could still, under 1149, sign up for long-term contracts, which I believe, long-term being...
I believe 1149 does require you to divest generation assets. It's just not yet.
Not yet. It requires the Commission get to a competitive market structure, however that is defined.
This is generation assets.
Now, the important point, though, about what you just said about California and how this could help, one of the things that California struggled with was uncertainty. A year ago, the California utilities did not know whether if they made longer-term supply arrangements, the Commission would stand by them if those arrangements turned out to be not as attractive a year or 2 years down the road. With this kind of a concept, the California utilities could have gone to their Commission and say, let's work that out. here are the trade-offs. We can commit now to power at $40 a megawatt hour, but we're going to be stuck for 3 years. So if the price goes down to 20, you're still going to have to pay 40. And the commission could have said, that's acceptable to us. Let's make that deal. The California utilities had no way to do that. And so they didn't buy the $40 power because they were worried about the $20 risk. Now, of course, they're facing $100 or $200 power. But if they're, what we are after is a way to take some of the uncertainty out of the system by having the discussion up front before we've made a decision. And then we can simply go with the decision that's been made.
Mr. Chair, Jay Dudley and Representative Lowe, just another comment that the contract would allow more flexibility in for the utility to build supplies and acquire supplies, and getting more supplies in the region and throughout the West is the best defense against higher prices, higher electric prices. So this is yet another tool to facilitate more flexibility in acquiring supplies for Portland General and all of the utilities. That's going to help in the defense against higher prices, just as Ms. Lesh was saying.
Could we explore a couple of points that you brought up, and one of them deals with the issue of what would happen in the event of a bankruptcy, and what would happen if market conditions change drastically and you want to go back to the negotiating table. Mm-hmm. I can understand that might help you be more flexible in responding to radical market changes in supply. I am concerned, however, that those variations will be passed on rather directly and immediately to the consumer. I'm concerned about that. And what would also happen in the event that you do become economically unstable and what you anticipate that this bill will do under those circumstances?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lowe, the Commission's in control of this contract. If they want the contract to embody essentially the arrangements we have now, or what we do if we get in financial difficulty, or really anything about our current circumstances, that's what we would capture in the contract. It's just if they want to change that balance, they also could do that. There's a lot of uncertainty in the current environment. If we, and we've seen this happen to other utilities around us, not so far to PGE, but some are paying a lot more for power than they're collecting from their customers. It may not be being passed through to them right away, but it's being recorded in an account and will be passed through later. Some things you simply can't work around. But if I think that contract notion, we are unlikely to use it for example, all of the supply we acquire for customers, or certainly not one monolithic contract. Because particularly today, there is so much volatility. We'll likely be under a different regulatory framework. We have a fairly innovative mechanism in place right now where we share gains and losses with our customers. And we're happy with that. That's working very well. This is really more forward-looking and is not for the immediate circumstances that this region finds itself in at all.
Jay, why don't you proceed and go through the section.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'll just quickly go through the sections of the bill. Section number 2 expands the commission's mission. It's in addition to the commission's general duties under ORS 756.040, this adds language encouraging the Commission to construe its laws and adopt and implement rules to respond to today's environment. It also adds an obligation to report to the legislature the Commission's activities in furtherance of these expanded goals. Section 3 modifies the use of services in the utility statutes to refer to regulated services. the commission's jurisdiction over these services and any other matters specifically given to it by the legislature. And I want to emphasize there that the commission retains all of its other jurisdiction over utilities, including for safety, for financing, and other aspects here. But it just makes clear what the subset of things that the utility does that the commission does regulate. Section 4 modifies ORS 5757.040 to be consistent with the commission's authority over regulated services, and there's no intent to change any of the commission's authority over telephone companies. And indeed, throughout this bill, there's no intent to change commission's authority over any other entity, water companies, special districts, municipalities, PUDs, co-ops, and so forth. Section 5 amends ORS 757.005 to define regulated services. What is used is the same definition of electricity services that are carried over from SB 1149. This change removes the confusion over what is a service that triggers the commission's jurisdiction and requires the company to tariff that offering. The commission does retain the control over the scope of electricity services. In other words, what is or is outside that box that Ms. Lesh was describing is a subject of rulemakings and perhaps declaratory rulings and other proceedings by the commission. The amendments here are drawn to eliminate any effect upon, as I said before, telecommunications regulation, water company, and any other special districts. Section 7 adds a new section clarifying that everything an electric utility does that is not regulated is an unregulated activity. This section prevents cross-subsidization between regulated and non-regulated services. It establishes the commission's authority to establish a uniform system of accounts and cost allocation methodologies that keep track of unregulated activity. This will assure there's no cross-subsidization to the harm of consumers. Section 8 amends 757.020 to confirm that the utility's duty to furnish adequate and safe services also applies to regulated services. Also, the amendment confirms that the commission will set just and reasonable rates for regulated services. And the last sentence of that section confirms that the commission will set just and reasonable rates for unbundled portions of regulated services. Section 10, this is the section that talks about the authority to enter into the regulatory contract that we've had the discussion on. It allows the regulated services to be broken into one or more parts, and I emphasize it has to be done with a willing commission and a willing utility. The contract contains commercially reasonable provisions for the term, the scope, price to consumers, compensation, performance measures, termination, dispute resolution, allocation of risk, amendment and renewal, all the sort of things you'd expect to find in a commercial contract. The term can be from 1 to 10 years. Section 11, this is a new section that authorizes the commission to establish charges to consumers for services covered by the regulatory contract that are different from compensation paid to the utility in balanced collections of payments through itself, utility, or third party. Like the contract, this section is optional with the commission. Section 12, this is a new section that establishes the contract is approved by a final order of the commission. This allows all parties appeal rights under existing utility statutes. It confirms that the contracts may not be amended without the consent of both the commission and the utility, and with notice and opportunity for public comment. Section 13 is a new section that allows the commission to exempt certain services provided in the contract from selected utility statutes. As with the contract itself, exemption of some of the statutes is optional with the commission as part of the contract negotiation. Section 14, this is a new section that gives the circuit court jurisdiction over any contractual disputes between the public utility and the commission. Consumers will be third-party beneficiaries of the contract and will have enforcement rights in the circuit court. Sections 15 to 17, these sections make technical amendments that reflect the commission authority over regulated services. Section 18 is one we have committed to remove from this bill. It lists a 3% cap on deferral amortizations allowed under 757.259. Sections 19 to 24 These sections make technical amendments to reflect the commission authority over regulated services. And at the very end, sections 25 to 29, these sections allow the creation of a new entity, a transmission company, that can work on and develop high-voltage transmission power lines. This will facilitate the formation of independent transmission companies. These companies are an essential addition to promote the development of new transmission facilities to relieve transmission congestion in Oregon. These amendments are not intended to change the duties of co-ops, PUDs, or other special districts. Jim Hill, members of the committee, that's an overview of the sections.
May I ask a couple of questions?
Yeah, well.
Thank you. Is there anything in this bill where it enacts it that would remove from consumers the usual and customary protections that they have to have provided to them the essential services, power, and so on, heat, lights?
Mr. Chair, Representative Love, the answer is no. All of the obligations of utilities are preserved throughout these changes. There's even provisions in there that the commission can ask a utility to, and command a utility, may I say, to go and serve customers in territory that the utility doesn't currently serve. All those sections and authority of the commission are all preserved.
And all the protections about interruption of service due to non-payment and so forth would continue to exist. I would like to direct your attention to page 4, line 30, where water services are now included. There are some water services in the state that are not included as essential services, I've been given to understand. Would this make that change and include all water services provided to the states within the essential service category that have those consumer protections under the Public Utility Commission statutes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, there is no intent to expand the commission authority over water companies than exists today. The commission does have jurisdiction over certain water companies. I would direct your attention to that same page, line 5. There's an exemption for water utilities serving less than 300 customers at an average annual residential rate of $18 per month or less that provides adequate and non-discriminatory service that does not provide wastewater services. That's in a section of that existing section that is exempt already. Those water utilities aren't covered by commission jurisdiction, and after this bill still would not be covered by commission jurisdiction.
That's pretty good. Too bad, though.
I guess we're going to load their leading clause is appropriate, so that's, you know, changes.
Hey, come on. You mentioned somewhere that a consumer would have standing to sue for enforcement or for breach. Could you show me where that lies? I've only just now seen this bill, so I haven't committed it to memory. I'm dancing as fast as I can, however.
Right. That would be section 14 on page 6. It's not explicitly stated there. The bill does provide that resolution of any dispute for regulated services is in an action in circuit court, unless, of course, the contract itself provides for binding arbitration. As a matter of straight legal contract principles, the consumers are third-party beneficiaries of that contract and have all contract enforcement rights under that contract to take their independent steps to get it enforced.
Well, now we've laid it in the record, so. A couple of other questions, if I could. Will you indulge me?
Certainly.
Thanks. Appreciate that. Now, I would assume that these contracts could be renegotiated under changing circumstances pretty much as a variable rate mortgage, or what were those called, ARMs? We got a lot of people in trouble in the 80s. Don't laugh at me, John. And assuming that the utilities would employ talented, gifted, and aggressive attorneys, such as they have seated with them now, to renegotiate these contracts? Would it be a fair assumption, or what protections would there be to for the consumer against ratcheting up the rates and the costs and the involvement, and particularly if the Public Utility Commission or the consumers themselves felt like it would be better to withdraw from the contract scheme altogether and just go back to straight PUC type regulation? Just allow for that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lowe, basically what would happen is this. It's easier for me to work with a real example than to talk in the abstract. So let's assume that we were going to put metering under one of these contracts. It's actually pretty suitable. The assets that are involved are recognized. We know what we want. We want at least a monthly read that meets certain accuracy requirements and so forth. So let's assume that's what we're dealing with. We'd all sit down and look at the costs associated with metering, what really drives them. And really what drives them is just how many people do you have moving in, so how many meters are you adding every year, what's failure rate, what affects the cost of reading them if you're still doing it manually, what kind of wage increases do you have to think about, fuel for people to drive around. You'd look at all those drivers, and you would price this contract. And you might say, that all looks pretty stable. Inflation's a factor, growth rate, but if we make this a per meter charge, that will grow as the meters grow. So you might decide, and parties might agree, there'd be no, you're going to do this for 5 years and there's no price escalation at all. Or you might provide them that after 3 years, the utility could have an inflationary adjustment. You might benchmark it to other utilities. You might say, well, look and see what Clark County is doing with its meter readers or something else. All of that would be possibilities, but it's also possible that it might simply just not allow a price reopener at all. So that would be, the basic deal would be, let's say, we'll just make this up, it's $5 per read per month. The utility can obtain that any way it wants, using its equipment, or if it finds a wonderful new way to get measurement, it could do that, as long as it meets the standards, and you do it for 5 years. Then at the end of the 5 years, the parties might agree, well, we'll give ourselves two options. We can renegotiate, and again, we might look to what are comparable utilities paying for this service, try and get their costs, and build yourself a new price for the contract that way. Or it may be suitable to say, let's give ourselves a choice to bid this. And by bidding it, we have to have agreed up front how we would, what we would charge to transfer the assets, the meters, so that the new entity providing the service could take those over. And then other people could say, well, I'll do it for $4 a month. And if
it would allow you a lot of subcontracting, in other words.
Yeah, you could do subcontracting, and you could.
And the PUC wouldn't have a say in who does the service.
Well, they get
or
to
they
choose
could,
who
the contract term.
Yeah, they choose the contract. But that's how it would work in my mind. So the issue of reopeners really would be designed to fit what the services that you had covered by the contract. One of the things that unbundling allows us is ability to say, to recognize for the first time that our costs have really different drivers. That the things that drive the cost of distribution system are really different from the things that drive the cost of generation, and they're different from transmission. So as we can start dealing with them in pieces, we can get a lot more precise about all of this. And I think that should ultimately provide better value and lower cost to consumers, because we don't have to just push one place to get the whole thing right. We can work in a number of different places and encourage efficiency in those places.
Is there anything in this bill that would allow, once you go hand in hand down the garden path together under contract, anything for to allow a divorce and to return to the old system?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lowe, certainly you could provide at the end of the term that it just ends and you go back to cost of service.
Right. But that's a negotiated term.
Right.
And but again, two strong parties are negotiating at arm's length, then a term over which the consumer has no control, correct?
Well, through the commission they do.
Wow.
And they can appeal.
Well, and maybe I can add something here, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lowe. The ultimate protection, of course, is that if the PUC does not want to enter into the contract, it doesn't have to.
Even having once done so,
the contracts will be negotiated for specific terms. There may very well be early termination clauses.
Right.
There may be any types of clauses that the PUC insists there must be in the contract. It's more of an experiment than anything else. It's a chance to see whether or not some flexibility can be built into the system. But if the PUC is uncomfortable in any way about entering into any aspect of the contract, they need not do so. This is not a legislative direction for them to do it. It just merely gives them the option to, if they would.
Have you got a package?
Would we need this particular piece of legislation if we weren't in the middle of utility deregulation under 1149?
Chairman, Representative Patridge, I think absolutely yes. Regardless of whether some of our customers can choose a different supplier, we strongly believe that it is time to unbundle our services, price them separately, look at them as they are separately done, so that we can move forward and have some innovation in this system. So we really would like to go forward with this, regardless what happens to the issue of customers choosing different suppliers.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative Patridge, I would just suggest that with creative thinking, there is almost an endless number of things that can be done under this contract. For example, I'm a member of a service club, and for years, every Tuesday lunch, I had a member come up to me and complain that he wanted undergrounding at his house, but somebody in his cul-de-sac didn't want it, and because of the rules, he couldn't get undergrounding. Well, under a contract, it's a small thing, but under a contract matter like this, we could enter into a contract, do the undergrounding, find the appropriate people to charge, and have a contract for a payback for 10 years with the affected customers to do undergrounding. Something that can be done that can't be done under current rules. There can be any number of things. Suppose a community wanted a billing office in its downtown area, and we otherwise wouldn't have put a billing office there. Well, a contract could allow us to have a contract with that city that to have a billing office there, or if a city wanted to have undergrounding for its particular core area that it was too clumsy to do under other ways, a contract will allow it. And so I'm thinking even in small areas that don't pose a lot of risk for the customers, this is an approach that could get a better utility service even without the restructuring environment that we're in right now.
Just a follow-up, Mr. Chair. So can you explain to me if this would be a good idea under either regulated or under deregulation under 1149 that we passed last time, since it's in the whereas clause to this particular bill? Can you explain to me the difference in what a utility would do to invest in building infrastructure and other things that would be of benefit to Oregon ratepayers and the general public, whether that be general public, be the businesses or private citizens, under either scenario if we adopt this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Patridge, one of the biggest benefits I see under this construct, using a regulatory contract, if the commission is willing, is the ability to remove some uncertainty from the system. Uncertainty about whether your investment will be recoverable, whether your infrastructure investment will be recoverable, is probably one of the things that has contributed to the circumstances that we're in now. Very little generation got built in the 1990s because it was uncertain whether it would be needed, who would pay for it. There were discussions of direct access, and it was simply uncertain, and there was no way to remove that uncertainty within the traditional cost of service framework. You need to make your decision, build it, and then you ask to recover it. This would give us a way, even on something as seemingly non-controversial as distribution infrastructure, to make it definite and certain. but it would also allow us to look for other ways to provide the result that new distribution infrastructure would provide, and maybe do it less expensively or with more value.
President Patridge.
So wouldn't this actually provide some kind of hybrid? Say we went, since I like the relate, since I'm one of the people who voted against deregulation, and a bill to repeal deregulation could actually fit within the context of this particular bill, wouldn't this provide some kind of hybrid piece in terms of a lot of the arguments that were made around why we should deregulate power? Wouldn't that solve some of the issues up front by allowing contracting like this to occur, so utilities then would know where their investment and how their return would be perceived, and consequently that would solve a lot of the reason that people people drove for the utility deregulation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Patridge, I have to say we continue to support Senate Bill 1149 as long as our customers do. That being said,
you have several members of this panel who didn't vote for power deregulation, however, and this is an appropriate relating to clause in which it could be
That being said, this is an evolutionary tool. It allows you to evolve utility services. It allows you, as Jay suggested, to begin to differentiate those services, working first with the entire customer base of a utility, but then maybe finding a subset that a particular service is good for, and gradually shrinking that down to ultimately the heart of direct access is to allow a one-on-one contract between a customer and the supplier. So this is an evolutionary path to get there. We assumed in drafting it that there was, for the supply piece only, already that choice. But this would, for all the other pieces, this complements that one by beginning to allow that same thinking that is behind the notion that you could deal with your own supplier to get to other pieces of our utility services.
I guess, Mr. Chair, I perceive this as maybe being a half loaf to allowing the innovation that helped fuel part of the deregulation piece during the last legislative session to assure the utility some level of return and create some innovation and investment without having to go the full step of deregulation. I'm just telling you what my perception is based upon this particular piece of legislation that's before the committee. And so I'm trying to get out what do we gain by doing this under either scenario, and I'm not quite sure what we gain and what we can expect to gain. It's great to put more tools in the toolbox.
Yeah.
But if we're going to be an innovator and a leader, in light of what California did, being an innovator and a leader, and the consequences that they are subject to currently, I'm cautious to tread forward, I suppose. So I guess my question is, what can we expect out of PGE, and do you think other utilities for investment should we adopt these kinds of tools?
Chairman Representative Patridge, I think that's a good question. What you can expect out of...
Wouldn't ask it if it was.
Yes, I do. What you can expect out of us is for us to look for opportunities to use this. One we've identified already is a small 24.9 megawatt generating unit we'd like to put. Actually, we're in the process of putting at our Beaver generating plant site on the Columbia River. We'd like to take that power and make a contractual arrangement with our customers that basically shares the benefit of that unit. We will look at metering. There's a lot of opportunity for innovation in metering. Not a lot has happened for a very long time. Uncertainty is part of the reason very little has happened. I think we'll look at that. I think we'll look for other pieces, baby steps, so that we can grow our way into this, test some things that might be 1-3 year contracts first for very discrete items, see what works, fine-tune it, do it a little bit more adventuresome the next time around. That's what we'll be trying to do.
Would this not also be the vehicle in terms of, in which there's a lot of discussion in terms of delay,
in terms of we're offering a cost of service option. Would this be a vehicle or a mechanism in which the commission could enter into an agreement with utilities in terms of to provide a cost of service rate for an extended period of time in terms of to weather volatile markets, in terms of to ensure that bring stability into a marketplace and where present law does not really allow that flexibility?
Mr. Chairman, present law is really not too bad with respect to the supply side. Yes, we could sit down with the commission to decide what they want that cost of service rate to look like. And in particular, as I was mentioning earlier in response to a question Representative Lowe had, it's the term of the commitment the customers are willing to make. So if the commission decided that a five-year commitment would really get us better prices, and I would tell you we're not seeing that in the marketplace right now, but perhaps in another 6 to 12 months we would be, and they said 5 years would do it, yes, we could use this concept to basically lock that in and say that is what we will go out and arrange a portfolio of resources for a five-year term, and this is the price it will be at, and then that is locked for 5 years. But that means customers couldn't walk away from it during the term of that either.
Well, how captive would the third-party beneficiary be under this scheme?
Representative Lowe, it's as captive as they are now under our utility service.
But unbundling and choices eventually available to the consumer.
These contracts would be negotiated in the environment, whatever environment we're in. So other state policies and laws provide or apply and have to be taken into consideration.
This is such a creative approach that it's hard to predict what the environment's going to be 6 months from now and how this will play in it. So, but somebody was thinking outside the box.
Emma, I'll just be frank. Does the commission possess the capability in terms of to deal with this broad kind of an open slate approach in terms of sitting down, negotiating, and coming to terms with something? I mean,
Mr. Chairman, I think they do. And whatever they feel they lack, there's numerous people out there that could advise them, just as they've talked to bringing in experts to help on ROE. This is a lot less arcane than return on common equity and the capital asset pricing model. So I think they do, and in fact have demonstrated that in working with us on some of the discrete projects we've been working on.
May I ask a couple of questions? Have you participated with consumer groups and so forth, other groups, worker groups that would be affected by such a contract?
Right.
Whose working conditions would be pretty much fixed under a long-term contract, that sort of thing. Have you talked
about it? We've been working on this idea for almost 2 years, and have had it's through its own evolution. Because, as you say, it is a stretch. It feels logical to me, but I recognize it's a definite change from the environment we're in. But anyway, pretty much within a few months of when we first began to formulate it, we have been talking with people the last year or so. We went around and spent some time with most of our major constituent groups, utility board, staff, industrial customers, environmental groups, about how this would work. So, yes, we've done some of that.
But you haven't specifically mentioned consumer groups.
Since utility board and the industrial customers. And,
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've had the Public Utility Commission in front of this committee and
our hybrid joint Ways and Means Committee as well as this particular committee. It encourages the commission to participate in doing some of these kinds of things and innovative approaches, but there's no standard by which we as a legislative body, I guess, can ensure that we explore some of these options. And I'd like to explore that particular piece. I think nobody out there would argue whether you're for or against deregulation or whatever, that we need to put more generating assets on the ground in the Pacific Northwest, that there are some other things that need to get done, that this would provide a framework upon which to build. And so I guess my question would be, you know, this is a great approach if we flop it out there, but I mean, what's going to happen with the PUC? Is there some standard by which we should, that we should look at making the PUC look at these things in some kind of objective framework to move forward?
Chair, Representative Patridge, the only way to do that would be to make the bill directory. We chose, from a policy point of view, to make it within the discretion of the PUC. The reason was, and I found this just in my experience, that when you have parties together, multiple parties, who have interests in contracts or the provision of a service or something like that, the best way to get them to be thinking, as we've been talking about, outside the box, you know, to use that term, is to have a certain element of volition there. When people feel they're forced to do something, they tend to be less imaginative sometimes than if they can approach the problem as or they can approach the negotiation as a way in which all sides can win in attempting to get towards a common goal. So, you know, the company, if this bill passes, does intend to advocate this approach, to take incremental steps towards advocating it. We feel that this, again, is another tool that the PUC can utilize should the energy situation worsen. And we feel in a volitional type environment that it might encourage people to engage in some real creative thinking. So, thank you.
And perhaps, as Mr. Dudley noted when he went through the section by section, it does ask for a report on the new purposes clause. Perhaps we could add also a request that the commission note the instances that it considered using a contract for and whether it had done so. So just add a bit to the list of things they would tell the legislature that they had worked on in the intervening 2 years.
Okay. Well, I apologize. I'm going to cut it off here. We're past 5 o'clock. I apologize. We just got a late start because of the other committee running over. And then we will bring back and we'll continue the other testimony. Representative Patridge?
Sure. I'd like to see what some amendments to this particular bill look like if we put a repeal 1149 in there and then put this piece forward. Can we ask Mark to draft those?
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3696, and without objection, we are adjourned.